Hello, this is Chris Long with the 10th episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. It is clear now that the human slave trade is very much alive in paradise. It seems to be the reason for many murders. Chapter 75. Mako was on the phone once more. It was his friend. Details were gone over. The latest encounter with Chrissy Murdoch had convinced Mako that his schedule had to be sped up. The friend was sympathetic and agreed to be ready, but he reminded Mako of their deal. Mako impatiently answered the man. It would be done. He clicked off the phone and looked down at the floor of his room at the Sierra. He stiffened when the paper was slipped under his door. He didn't move for a few seconds, wondering if something or someone was going to follow the paper in. He reached under the bed and pulled out the pistol from where he had slid it between the springs. He rose, inched toward the door, touched the paper with his foot, and moved it toward him. Keeping his eyes on the door, he knelt and picked up the paper. He moved away from the door and opened the folded page. Two words, two meaningful words, they're coming. Mako folded up the paper and slipped it into his pocket. He could attempt to follow the person who had given him this warning, but he chose not to. They're coming. 20 minutes later, he didn't hear or see anything coming. He sensed it was something other than his ears and his eyes. Perhaps it was their smell, the smell of death coming. It could be quite potent. He reached under the bed, snagged two more items, rose, opened the door, and moved to his left with a speed that was belied by his immense frame. There was too much light here for what he wanted. He entered the stairwell and moved down one flight at a time, pausing at each landing, waiting, sensing. He was using facilities that most people would never discover they had. But when you had lived as Mako had, those faculties rose to the surface, at least for those who survived. He left the building at the ground floor and headed west. The people were good. Not because they had found him at the Sierra. That would take no skill at all. No, they were good because they had followed him from his room down to here. Even now he could sense their approach. One set from the left, one set from the right. He slipped his gutting knife into his waistband and then spun the suppressor onto the end of his pistol. He kept walking, zigzagging his route and moving closer and closer to the water. These back streets were deserted. Not even the duenos were out. He wondered about this. But then he thought perhaps they had been told to stay off the streets tonight. The duenos considered themselves tough until they ran into those who were truly formidable. Then the street toughs melted away into little balls of dough and found places to hide in the darkness, like the mice they were. Mako was not, and never would be, a mouse. He walked on instinctively, varying his route, but heading inevitably to the water, to the gulf. It had carried him here from a position of slavery, though the last part of his journey had been as a free man swimming for his life. He would go back to the sanctity of the water tonight. It would either be his final resting place or simply one more bump in a long road of life of them in his life. Sometimes all a person could do was not good enough. So be it. He had never been one to regret, not when it came to survival. He passed some late-night stragglers who were too drunk to see that he was walking along with a pistol. He turned down one more street and the deepness of the ocean stretched ahead of him. It was secluded. It was completely dark. There were no people around who could see or be harmed by what was about to happen, and the tide was coming in. Tides were often handy. He quickened his pace. In a few more seconds, he was on his scooter, which he had hidden behind a trash receptacle, and was flying down the sand. This had surprised the men following him. That was his intent. His other intent was to draw them farther down the beach, away from the town, away from any eyes, drunk or not. 2 miles later, he was away from all such eyes except for the ones still chasing him. He had not gone fast enough to lose them. Mako's thinking was simple. He could deal with this now, or he could deal with this later. Might as well get it over with. Mako calculated he was facing 6 men. They would be trained, armed, cagey, cautious, but with enough close-quarter combat skills to size up the ever-evolving battlefield. The dunes were up ahead. He left his scooter behind and set out on foot. A minute later, he skirted a narrow cleft between 2 dunes. His front flank was now a funnel his pursuers would have to breach, but it was only wide enough for one man to come through at a time, a classic defensive measure, the same one the Spartans had employed to hold off the far larger Persian army so the Greeks could escape destruction. That same technique had been taught in war colleges ever since. If your opponent has far larger numbers, make it as difficult as possible for them to employ those numbers to their advantage. Mako knew this sort of confrontation might happen, so he had hunted for this sort of tactical advantage shortly after he arrived in Paradise. And then he had spent time doing something to it that would hopefully work to his advantage. The dunes were thick enough to stop any ordnance unless they were going to attack him with shoulder-fired missiles, and he doubted that was the case. Mako only had two worries now, his rear flank and something coming through that opening other than a man. His next steps would address both issues at once. The man after Mako fanned out in a classic attack formation. With a numerical advantage of 6-1, it would be successful against just about any foe. The cleft in the dunes was just ahead. A funnel. These men had seen that one before. One way in and one way out. None of them had any plan or desire to breach that opening with Mako waiting to pick them off as they came through. But they had come prepared for just such a scenario. The first man approached, keeping well back of the cleft. He lifted the fish-shaped metal object from his pocket, engaged it, and tossed it through the opening. It wasn't a grenade, but it was as good as one. He turned away from the cleft and used his hands to cover his ears as additional protection over the plugs he wore. The flashbang went off, blinding light, paralyzing sound, and a concussive force kicker. Anyone in the dune would now be immobilized, easy to kill. The six men swarmed through the cleft. Sand dislodged by the flashbang was swirling everywhere. They had guns ready to fire into the paralyzed man, who should now be resting on the sandy floor. He would never know how he died. The space between the dunes was barely 10 by 10. The space had resulted from erosion, wind, and different compactness levels of the sand. The men crowded in, but there was no one lying immobilized on the ground. What the leader of the squad did see was a now visible knotted rope dangling in the center of the space. He looked up to where the rope was attached to the thick limb of a tree 20 feet up. None of the men had looked up before coming in here. They had focused on the cleft. But what was currently up was now coming down. Mako landed on two of the men, and they broke his fall by breaking their necks. A third man was gutted by Mako's knife. The bodies of the first two kills covered with blood from his dissected belly. Number four caught two rounds in his face from Mako's pistol. Number five tried to run. One big arm around his neck stopped that retreat, and the snap of the spine was followed by the man collapsing to the sandy ground. Number six got lucky, however. Mako had stumbled over number five as the man's legs involuntarily kicked out as he went through the last spasms of death. Six drew his bead on Mako with his MP5. Shot selector on full auto, 30 rounds fired in a couple of seconds, if that, not survivable. Pistol and knives useless against that. Mako looked at six. Six looked back at Mako. A triumphant smile, a finger on the trigger ready to finish the job. Mako had a millisecond left to live, and there was absolutely nothing he could do about it. One shot erupted, but it didn't come from the MP's muzzle. A hole opened in number six's forehead. The MP had no chance to do its killing because its owner had just died. Six fell headlong into the sand. Some of his brain splattered along the wall of the dune behind him because the shot had come from in front of him and behind Mako. Mako whipped around in that direction, pistol and knife up and ready. Chrissy Murdoch stood there. She was not outfitted in Hermes and Chanel tonight, nor a bikini. She wore all black. Dark smudges were under her eyes and over her thin, high cheeks. The eyes looked very different from the pampered ones of the person lounging around the pool at Peter Lambert's estate. They were hard and dark and cold. They are like mine, thought Mako. She held a pistol. It was pointed at Mako's heart. She looked at him, and he looked back at her. She slipped the gun into a belt holster and said, "We have to get rid of the bodies. I have a boat. Let's move." As she came forward to do this, Mako could only stare. She struggled to lift one of the men. Mako still hadn't moved. She glanced sharply at him. I said, let's go. You were the one who warned me. Who else? He put the pistol and knife away and started to help her. Chapter 76. Puller eased out from behind a tree and did a sweep of the area with his night vision goggles. He had picked the surveillance spot with the same care he would on a battlefield. It gave him maximum observation coverage with minimal exposure to prying eyes. Carson sipped a bottle of water and watched him. It was hot, muggy, and the sulfur smell was nauseating. It was also 2 in the morning, and they had been here for 3 hours. He sat back next to her. She said quietly, anything? He shook his head, kept his gaze moving. How much longer do we wait? As long as it takes, General. These things don't run on a schedule. So all night? Daylight comes, we'll leave. They won't be doing anything in the daytime, even at a place like this. What do you think it is? Puller shrugged, leaned back against the tree, but remained tensed, ready to move in an instant if need be. Drugs, guns, the Colombians have lost the drug pipeline to the Mexicans, but the Gulf is still full of traffickers. Then it could get pretty dicey tonight. We might not have enough firepower. This is an intelligence-gathering expedition only, no engagement. We take what we find to the proper authorities. We might not have a choice about engagement if we're spotted. Risk of the battlefield. On U.S. soil, no less. Didn't teach us that at the Army War College. Maybe they should have. Yeah. Maybe they should have. I'll speak to the appropriate parties about it, if I survive hanging with you. They fell silent until Carson said, something else on your mind? Puller didn't look at her. There was something else on his mind. He had continued his investigative work, prompted by looking at his watch outside of Griff Mason's hideaway. And everything he had found out only reinforced his suspicions. It didn't sadden him, it angered him, but he would have to productively channel that anger. He looked forward to the opportunity to do so. Just a jumble of things, he said. Carson was about to say something else when Puller put up a hand. Stay down, he hissed. A few seconds later, Carson heard what Puller's quicker senses had already registered. The truck crept along the surface road, shielded by a line of trees. It turned and puttered down toward the water, easing into the small park-off where the driver killed the engine. Several men got out, even as Puller and Carson hunkered down at their observation post. Puller held up a finger, indicating to Carson that they would communicate solely via nonverbal signals from now on. She nodded in understanding. Lying prone in the sand, Puller intensified the power of his night vision goggles and pointed them at the truck, which sat about 100 yards away from their position. At first, Puller was thinking that another vehicle would meet the truck, but that didn't make any sense. Truck and truck at a clandestine meeting site was not logical. Moving over the road, you'd get a warehouse and do your transfer in privacy. The only reason to drive down near the water was if you were expecting a delivery from the water. A minute later, Puller's deduction was proved correct. The whine of the boat wasn't much, but water was a great conductor of sound. The boat was moving fast, and within 30 seconds, Puller could see the outline of what he almost immediately recognized as a RIB. It was the same type of amphibious boat the Rangers used. As the RIB grew closer to shore, Puller could make out many people on board, too many for the boat's small footprint. Carson touched his arm. He looked at her, found her pointing back toward land. Puller focused that way and saw the men from the truck coming down to the beach. Right now, he would have given anything for a night camera to record what was about to happen. People were being pulled off the RIB. When they hit the sand, Puller could see that they were bound and their mouths taped shut. They also wore different colored shirts. Puller flipped up his goggles and saw green, red, and blue. He felt a gentle squeeze on his arm and turned to see Carson staring over his shoulder. She looked at him. He shook his head and turned back to what was happening on the beach. The people were herded up the sand into the truck where 2 men were posted there to guard them. Puller turned the attention back to the beach, where the RIB had disappeared, but another one was now approaching the beach. The scenario that had just happened on the beach was repeated with this second group. A third RIB beached, disgorged passengers, and left. Then a fourth Araibi came and did the same. After the last boat left, the truck was locked, and three men climbed into the cab. Carson said, "What do we do now?" Puller was thinking this very same question. "What do we do? We need to call the police right now." But Puller shook his head, "No." She looked at him in bewilderment. "No? Are you crazy? These people were prisoners, Puller." "Yeah, I can see that. Then we call the cops." "Not yet. When do you think that might be a more suitable time?" Puller looked at the truck as it started to pull away. "Let's go," he said. Chapter 77. Puller kept back as far as he could from the truck while still keeping it in sight. It was tricky. Headlights back here at this time of night would no doubt make the guys in the truck dangerously suspicious. Carson alternated between looking at the taillights of the truck and scowling at Puller. "I'm still not getting this tactic, Puller. If you don't call the police for something like this, what then?" He said nothing but kept his gaze upon the truck as it wound around the curves, with thick trees on both sides. They might as well have been in a forest. There was no hint of the nearby ocean except for the occasional whiff of brine. He finally looked at her. "Well-timed op, scheduled secluded spot, middle of the night. Bring them in by water, truck them out." "Right, so? How many nights you think they do this?" "I have no way of knowing that." "Let's say they do it 3 or 4 times a week, maybe 7 days a week." "Maybe not. Maybe we just got lucky." "No one is that lucky." "And your point? Maybe this is what my aunt saw, or what the Storo saw." "Maybe it is. My aunt was a good upstanding citizen. The Storos were, by all indications, pillars of the community." "Granted, they probably were. And you think these elderly, solid citizens saw what we saw and didn't tell the police?" Carson started to say something and then stopped. "So your point is they did tell the police and nothing happened?" "Oh, something happened. They ended up dead, all of them." "You think the police are in on what we just saw?" "I don't know how you can run an op like that, even once a week, and trust that the cops are not going to happen upon you. All it would take is one cop on patrol seeing a boat light, or the truck, or just happening to walk down the beach and see what we saw. And they couldn't risk that? We just saw 4 RIBs. They're not long-distance boats. That means there's a larger vessel out there that they launched from. I counted 80 people off the boats, and now they're in the back of that truck. You're talking equipment, money, and manpower. The payoff has to justify that. Like you said before, drugs, guns. They were people. General. No guns, no drugs. So maybe drug mules? And they were young women, so prostitutes. And bigger, older men, maybe slave laborers. Slave laborers in America? Why not? I thought we fought the Civil War to take care of that little bit of evil. If it's profitable, evil can come back strong, just like a cancer with fresh bloodlines to feed off. Damn, Puller, do you really think that's what this is about? A pipeline is a pipeline. You can run lots of things through it. And the police? Part of the equation. Paradise is wealthy and a tourist destination, and no one wants to rock the boat, and maybe the cops are paid to look the other way. Hell, maybe the whole damn town is. I can't believe that. Maybe not. But if I'm those guys, I'm not pulling an operation like this together and risking a cop stumbling onto it and blowing it out of the water. Something like that has to come from the top. So, Bullock? Maybe. I was surprised at how quickly he turned into my friend. I wonder who's running the op from the other end. My bet is on the guy who got this Bentley blown up. What, Lambert? How do you figure that? I checked the guy out. Made and lost a fortune, then made another one back, obviously. Only I can't find out how, and he screws the hired help. And maybe they're not hired at all. Maybe he's got slaves on his plantation. Okay, let's say he is the guy. Why would someone blow up his car? Maybe a guy with size 16 shoes has a beef with the man. Size 16 shoes? He's the same guy who saved my butt the other night. I don't think he did it out of kindness. And maybe he regrets it now. But he may be the one after Lambert. He works on the landscaping crew. Why do I want to bet he works the Lambert estate? And his beef with Lambert? No idea, and I may be backing up the wrong tree, but guys that big with skills like he has are rare, and I can't believe he came here to cut the grass. So with the knowledge in hand, what do? Call in the army, the DEA, the Border Patrol? We need to know more. If we start making noises and they have moles on the inside, we'll never get the evidence we need to put them away. They'll be gone, never to return. Well, when we find out where that truck is going, we may have all the evidence we need. Puller suddenly punched the gas and the Tahoe sped up. What are you doing? They'll see you. We've already been seen. What? Twin bogeys behind us, and they're closing like an Abrams tank brigade on a soft target. She looked behind her and saw the set of twin beams coming all on way too fast. Oh! Carson lifted her pistol from its holster. Puller shook his head. Ineffective at this range and tactical position. Take my rifle. I'll pop the back window. Take up a position in the rear. Use the tailgate to steady the rifle. He eyed the rear view again. I'm thinking 50 yards. Aim for the windshield and the radiator. She was already scrambling over the seat. Roger that. He popped the window. She took her spot. Settled the rifle on the tailgate, but then she paused. Puller, what if it's the police or feds back there? A bullet shattered the back glass, covering Carson in shreds. Don't think so, said Puller. Fire now. Carson pumped 5 rounds from her rifle into the windshield and radiator of the first vehicle. It swerved and smoke started pouring from the hood. Carson fired 2 more and the windshield shattered completely and then came off in 1 large chunk. She could see the driver hunched over and then the vehicle flew off the road. 1 boogie down. Don't declare victory yet. Out of the smoky haze thrown off by the first vehicle, the second, an SUV raced, bearing down on them fast. These people were taking no chances. Bullets poured from twin gunmen hanging out the windows. The Tahoe's left rear wheel shredded. Puller, cried out Carson. I know. He fought the wheel, keeping it on the asphalt. Carson fired back, but then stopped. Keep shooting, snapped Puller. My rifle jammed. No! Barked Puller. He checked the rear view. Boogie coming fast. Major firepower. They had 1 bad wheel, and as he checked his fuel gauge, he saw it plummeting. 1 round must have pierced the fuel tank. We're losing gas, Carson called. I can smell it. They hit the tank. Carson looked back, and her eyes widened as the SUV came on hard and fast, its hood nearing the back of the Tahoe. Then it abruptly slowed and fell back. At first, Carson thought they were retreating, but then she saw something that told her otherwise. Puller, what? They've got an RPG. The man on the right side of the SUV was hanging out the side, getting a bead on them with a rocket-propelled grenade launcher riding on his shoulder. While another man inside the truck held on to him. That's why they had fallen back, to avoid the blast from ground zero when rocket and Tahoe plus leaky gas tank erupted in a flame ball. Carson ducked down as the man fired. It was a good thing she was holding on, because at that very moment, Puller, who'd been watching this unfold in the rear view, cut the wheel hard to the left at the exact instant the grenade launched. The Tahoe shuddered and then responded. The grenade passed by on the right, hit a bank of trees, and exploded. Carson tumbled across the rear of the truck's interior as the Tahoe skidded off the road and slid onto the shoulder. The rear door was ripped open, and a large hand flew in, grabbed Carson under the arm, and lifted her out of the Tahoe. The next instant, she and Puller were running for their lives. Chapter 78. They had 2 pistols and a jammed rifle between them. Puller led Carson to cover behind a dune. It wasn't perfect, but it didn't need to be. They looked at each other as they heard people running toward their general position. Tight spot, said Carson. Puller checked the pistols. We've both been in tighter. They haven't located us yet. It'll take some time. But they will. Yes, they will. Superior numbers and firepower. We're the underdogs, certainly. I don't mind that. It'll just take a little figuring to move us to the top of the food chain. I like your confidence. She looked at her phone. Can't call in the cavalry, no service. I know, I already checked mine. We need higher ground. Soldiers always want higher ground. He looked at her, apparently sizing her up for the question he was about to ask. You mind taking orders from an enlisted? Under the circumstances, I think I'm going to insist that I do. I've sat behind a desk too long. Your combat boots are fresher than mine are. You think you can hold this position alone? In response, she scrambled up the top of the dune, surveyed the beach, and then rejoined him. If they have another RPG round to fire, no. But if it's gun to gun, I can. For about 10 minutes, if I manage my ammo properly. I won't need that long, and I'm leaving both pistols with you. He handed the weapons to her. What are you going to do? Get to higher ground. As a sniper? But the rifle jammed on me. Pulla cleared the rifle's breech, checked the firing mechanism, and pronounced it workable. You think anyone heard what happened? The guns, the explosion? We're not that far out of town. We're too far out, and the breakers make a lot of noise. Okay. We'll make it, General. No doubt. But then every soldier wants to believe that. Good luck. It'll be about more than luck. She touched him on the arm. Counting on you to come back, John. There's only one thing that will stop me. Kasim knew what that was. Death. She drew a long breath and nodded. Okay. Pulla slung the rifle over his shoulder, and in a few seconds was gone. Kasim blinked. It was like he had simply vanished, and for a man as big as he was, that took some skill. But then again, he's a ranger, she thought. That's what they do. She gripped her Glock, racked the side, slid her secondary weapon, Pulla's M11, into the back of her waistband, and took up her defensive position in a slot she borrowed on top of the dune. She was trying to make herself as invisible as possible. You couldn't kill what you couldn't get a bead on. Gun on gun, she could hold this piece of sand for a time, but after that it would just be inevitable. She would die. And if they fired another grenade, she would be blown into little bits of organic matter. She crossed herself, settled in, and took aim. Chapter 79. Pulla had sized up the battlefield and chosen his high ground. Now he knew he simply had to get there, fastest with the mostest, and in that he had pretty much summed up the winning strategy of every military campaign ever fought. When opposed by superior numbers and firepower, it was essential to hit the other side fast and hard and in multiple spots. This would hopefully cause confusion, blunt any momentum they might have, and ideally force a tactical retreat. Pulla would be just fine with confusion, but then he would also be just fine with killing all of them. He found his spot and shinnied up a tree, coming to rest in the crook formed by the tree and a sturdy limb. He settled his rifle into place and sighted along the scope, dialing in necessary adjustments to fit the wind, distance to target, and other factors. There were 6 men. They came on in 2 groups of 3. They were moving in a V-shape, 1 leader and 2 followers. From Pulla's perch up the tree, they looked like 2 arrowheads moving forward across the sand. They had some military training, he deduced, but not as much as they should have. He scanned behind the men, looking for reinforcements, waiting to be deployed. He'd made that mistake at the Sierra. He didn't intend to make the same error again. No reserves. They were bringing their full force against one they presumed was a weaker force. Pulla's tactics had already been thought out. He didn't just line up 1 shot like a chess match. He was lining up 4. 2 from each group. That would leave it at 2-on-2. Odds he liked much better. He observed Carson burrowed in on top of the sand dune. He knew she would see the oncoming enemy, but she was holding her fire, awaiting his first strike. Then he knew she would know what to do, because she was a soldier just like him. On the battlefield, stars, bars, and stripes fell away. You were just 2 trained fighters using that training to defeat the other side. He glanced out at the water and saw a curious sight. It looked like a boat coming in. The navigation lights were steady red and green, so it was heading directly to shore. This might be backup coming from the big boat out there. If so, he had to get this skirmish on the beach over with pronto. He let out a breath, got his psychological barometer to cold 0, optimal for minimal muscle quiver, and lasered his crosshairs on target number 1. Bang, number 1 went down. Bang, number 2 hit the sand. Pulla had known what the other 4 would do when the first 2 went down. They scattered, but they scattered in a predictable pattern. Bang! Number 3 went down with one of Pola's 7.62 NATO rounds blowing a large hole in the man's chest. Bang! This shot came from a Glock. Number 4 went down and stayed there. Carson was emptying the clip from her Glock, spraying fields of fire both left and right, which were the only two directions worth aiming at because it would also cover fore and aft movements. She dumped her Glock and aimed the M11 but didn't fire. The two survivors down there had made it to cover, both from Carson below and Puller above. But Puller had gotten most of what he had wished for. It was now 2-on-2. The only unknown was the boat. But for that, he would have just played a waiting game, keeping the two pinned down until they lost their patience and made a run for it. It would have been a short run. Puller would get one, Carson would get the other. But the damn boat was coming on fast, so Puller didn't have the luxury of waiting. He looked down at the same moment Carson looked up. He didn't know if she could see him without the benefit of the goggles he had on, but she had obviously either seen or heard the boat. He shimmied down the tree, landing quietly in the sand. A minute later, he had rejoined Carson. Two left, he said. Right, but reinforcements are coming from the water. I know, I saw. Now what? Those two are between us and the road. So we have to remove the obstacle. We don't have time for a standard pincher movement, he said. What do you suggest, General? So I'm back in command? Superior rank is never really out of command. You earlier deferred to my judgment. Leadership defaults back to you. Feint, draw out, and strike. Speed and finality. I'll do the feint and draw. I was thinking the other way around. You're better with the rifle. We're close enough range to do it with pistols. And I know you've kept your certifications up. How? You're chasing the second star. You wouldn't let something that simple trip you up. I am damn good with a handgun and anything under 25 meters. Then we're well within your comfort zone. But the feint would get shot at. That's the hope. Did you really volunteer for all the dangerous assignments in Iraq and Afghanistan, too? All the assignments over there were dangerous. Puller checked the water again. The boat was almost there. We're out of time. Let's do it. It worked, nearly perfectly, but anything less than perfection under the circumstances was problematic. Puller took up position 15 meters off the left flank of the targets, who had committed the tactical blunder of retreating to the same spot. It marshaled their firepower, but also left them sitting ducks for the strategy devised by Carson. Carson had taken up her strike position 5 meters off Puller's left flank, down in the sand, the M11 positioned on the hard shell of a long-dead sea creature. She had the goggles on now. She had crystal-clear fields of fire. Now it was up to Puller to do the feinting just right. And he did, almost. He sprinted out of seemingly nowhere, a nearly 6-foot blur, wide-stepping through the sand, running a zigzag route as though traversing a minefield. The shots rang out almost immediately from the two men. Puller had chosen his angle well. It had made the two men step out from cover in order to draw a bead on him. Carson popped off 4 shots. They were well-placed, compact rounds, designed for close-quarter battle and max damage. 2 shots hit one man in the torso. The other 2 hit the other man in the exact same spots. Double-tapped, they dropped to the sand. So did Puller. Chapter 80. John! Carson raced forward through the sand. She reached him in seconds. He had already risen to one knee. Where? Left side, in and out. I think it was the first guy who fired. He obviously knows how to grid shot. Let's make sure it's out. She pulled up his shirt, felt around for the entry and exit points, and found them both. You're bleeding pretty heavily. I'll be okay. We need to get you to a hospital. I'm not arguing with that. In my duffel in the Tahoe, I've got some medical supplies. I'll patch myself up. I can patch you up, Puller. He looked over her shoulder. Okay, but right now, keep low. Get your gun ready and turn around. She flinched just for an instant. The boat? The boat, he replied. Ugh. She turned and saw what he had already seen. The boat was beached on the shore. There was no one in it. Looks like the opposition is already deployed. It's not a REB, maybe fewer people. More than 2 is problematic. We're clearly not at full strength. Can you manage, she asked. Not the first time I've been shot. I know. Puller took off his shirt and wound it around his middle to try to staunch the bleeding. He gripped the rifle and stood. How many rounds do you have in the M11, he asked. 10, you? 5, and then I'm out. How do you want to do this? Seek and destroy. I go left and you right. You see me fire, you fire at whatever I'm targeting. I'll do the same with you. Let's manage our ammo carefully. We need to kill what we can when we can, General. Hand to hand after that, if it comes to it. They hit you one time on your wound, you're going down. It'll take more than one time. Her lips parted, her eyes, she eyed the bloody shirt and said nothing before looking away. They split up, Carson moved toward the water, Puller the opposite way. 15 meters apart, they stealthily advanced, their gazes rotating side to side, up and down. Puller stopped when he smelled it. Sulfur was coming from his right, meaning Carson's left. They were up ahead. The stench on the clothes of whoever was out there was being driven into his nostrils by the breeze. And then Puller realized what that entailed. He and Carson carried the exact same stink. The wind changed, carrying their smell the other way. Down, he roared as shots flew overhead. He sank into the sand but did not return fire. He had no clear target. With only 5 rounds left, he had none to waste. He just hoped that Carson had heard his warning in time. He waited, his heartbeat hammering in his ears. He wanted to call out to Carson, but that would do neither of them any good. He had already told the other side there was more than one of them by calling out to her. He gazed ahead, sweeping the area in grids. Carson had the goggles. She would be able to see things he couldn't. He decided to play off whatever she did. He looked over and saw Carson on her belly, gliding forward. The sound of the breakers covered this movement. He did the same. Her movements became faster, and Puller, shot up as he was hard-pressed to keep up with her. Then it occurred to him that she wanted to get there first to absorb the attack or counterattack before he would be in harm's way. Screw that, he muttered, and redoubled his efforts. It all came to an end several seconds later. Carson jumped to her feet and aimed. Puller got there a millisecond later and did the same, his rifle finding and fixing on the target. One gun was pointed at Carson, one gun was pointed at Puller. Mako faced Puller. Chrissy Murdoch confronted Carson. Mako and Puller recognized each other at the same instant. Carson and Murdoch did not have the same advantage. Puller said, "Who the hell are you?" Mako looked back at him, his finger a bare millimeter from the trigger of his weapon. Murdoch kept her gaze dead on Carson. The woman's gun muzzles were barely 6 feet apart. "Who the hell are you?" Murdoch said. "Brigadier General Julie Carson, United States Army." Puller said, "Special Agent John Puller, Criminal Investigation Division, United States Army." Mako did not take his gaze off Puller. Puller did not take his gaze off Mako. He said, "Now who the hell are you?" Mako again said nothing. Puller eyed Murdoch. "The last time I saw you, you were in your bathrobe at Lambert's estate, and your name was Christine Murdoch." "That is my cover name. I'm actually Lieutenant Claudia Diaz with the Colombian National Police. I'm assigned to a joint task force between my country and yours." "For what purpose?" "Anti-slavery efforts. It has been authorized by your State Department." "And him?" "He's assisting me. He doesn't look Colombian to me." "That is because I am not Colombian," snapped Mako. "But you saved my butt the other night." "Why?" "I didn't like the odds. Too many against one." "Did you know who I was?" Mako shook his head. "Why are you helping her?" "That is my business," replied Mako. "Can we all show some creds?" said Carson. Puller, Carson, and Diaz pulled out their badges. Mako pulled nothing. "Where are you from?" asked Puller. "Not from here." "You're making this a lot harder than it has to be." "That is not my problem." Diaz said, "We were attacked by a half dozen of the slavers." "Seems to be going around, so were we." "And you obviously survived," Diaz said. "As did you." "We carried the bodies out to the ocean. I would recommend we do the same for you," said Diaz. "Why?" "To cover our tracks so the big fish do not get away." "I'm afraid they already have," said Puller. "The truck with the people got away." "Damn," said Diaz, and she was the first to holster her weapon. Carson followed suit. The two men did not budge. Their guns remained pointed at each other. Diaz said to Mako, "Stand down, Mako. They're obviously not with the slavers." "Puller, lower your weapon," said Carson. "Screw that. Him first." "The same," snarled Mako. Carson and Diaz looked at each other with exasperated expressions. "Men," said Diaz, "they have too much to tosterone, finished Kassin. Shall we? She added, and Diaz nodded. The women walked over and stood between the men's pointed weapons. Stand down, they said in unison. With their targets obstructed, Puller and Mako slowly lowered their weapons. Diaz looked at Puller. You've been shot. Yeah, that one I had figured out. You two have some filling in to do. Diaz said, but we also don't have much time. If the truck got away, they know what's happened. They will pull out of all their operations and we'll lose any evidence we might have. Puller glowered at Mako. Then we don't have any time to lose, do we? And I hope you can change your tire, big guy. Chapter 81. Mako changed the tire on the Tahoe and plugged the gas tank hole while Kassin and Diaz patched Puller's wound. You still need to get real medical treatment, Puller said Kassin. She's right, said Ada Diaz. Puller put his shirt back on and stared at each of them. Okay, first we get the bad guys, and then I go get stitched up. Deal? He glanced over at Mako. You done yet? Mako gave the last tire lug one final turn, and then rose holding the tire iron in one big hand. I'll drive. No, I'll drive, said Puller. You just tell me where. The woman rode in the back and cleaned and reloaded all their weapons. Mako sat next to Puller and gave him directions to the warehouse. Can you fight with your wound? Mako asked Puller without looking at him. There was no sympathy in the question. Puller neither expected nor wanted any. Mako simply wanted to know the physical status of his comrades in arms. He wanted to know if he could count on Puller or rather have to compensate for him. Puller would have wanted to know the exact same thing. They gave me a painkiller I had in my duffel. I can shoot and I can fight and I can take punishment, so don't worry about me. I'll handle my end, you cover yours. What about your woman? Can she hold her own? What about your woman? Can she? Are you always this cooperative? I don't even know who you are, so yeah, this is about as cooperative as it gets from me. Diaz will be fine. So will Kassin. They rode for another minute in silence. The only noise was the sound from the women readying the weapons. Finally, Mako said, My name is Gavriel. That is my given name. My surname would mean nothing to you, but people call me Mako. You're Bulgarian, said Puller. Mako glanced at him. How did you know? I fought with them in Iraq way back. They were great fighters and could drink any other nationality under the table, even the Russians. Mako smiled. The Russians think vodka is gold. It is merely water with perfume. It does not even put hair on the chest. Were you military? I used to be. Then things changed. What things? Neither man noticed that Kassin and Diaz had finished their work and were listening intently to this exchange. Bulgaria was no longer part of the Soviet Union, of course. But some things don't change. I love my country. It is a place of beauty. The people there are good. They like to work hard. They love their freedoms. But that does not mean that every leader we have is a good one who deserves the respect of the people. So sometimes when you do not follow along blindly, things happen to you. Were you imprisoned? Why do you say that? Because the Soviets were big on that, that's why, and Bulgaria was part of that world for a long time. For a time, perhaps a longer time than I care to remember. How did you end up here going after slavers? I come from a small village in the southwest part of my country. The Rila Range, it is called. It is remote. The people there work hard. There are few, if any, outsiders who come there. My family still lives there. Puller said, but outsiders did come. Mako nodded and glanced out the window so as not to show the tears forming in his eyes. Men came and promised things, a better life for our young people, education, jobs, all good things. They took about 30 of them. He paused, including my youngest sister. We are a large family. She is far younger than me. She was only 16 when she left. No, not when she left, when she was taken. They were slavers, said Puller. Mako nodded. Who thought that a little village on a mountain in Bulgaria would never be able to strike back for the evil that was done? I was not there at the time, or I would not have allowed this to happen. I have seen a lot of the world. The people in my village have not. They are trusting, too trusting. When I came back and found out what had happened, I started to look for my sister and the others. What's her name? This question came from Carson, who had put it a hand on Mako's big shoulder, gripping it. Rada, this is she. Mako took out the photo and held it out to Carson. She took it and looked at it. She's very beautiful. Not like the rest of the family, said Mako matter-of-factly. They look more like me, big and ugly. You are not ugly, Mako, Diaz said fiercely. You are a man trying to do the right thing. There is nothing more handsome than that. And you tracked her down to Lambert? Diaz answered while Mako took the photograph of Rada back from Carson and stared down silently at it. We have talked. He actually worked the connection from the other way, through Stephen Rogers. Rogers, exclaimed Carson. He's on our most wanted list. He's even been deemed a national security risk. He's involved in this? He collects the product, the people, and then they are transported to this country, said Diaz. Lambert takes over from there. He has established buyers everywhere. He gets the people to them. They are separated into three main categories. Prostitutes are the most value, next are drug mules, then common laborers. They wear different colored clothing that shows which category they fall into. I have seen this. Diaz nodded. We saw it tonight, Pola said. And you said he has buyers in the U.S. for slaves? The slave trade has never been more lucrative. As governments crack down on drugs and guns, it is becoming more and more popular. You need people to carry drugs. You need hookers to score tricks. And you need people to work the fields and the factories. If you don't have to pay them, or pay them very much, it is good for the bottom line. But it's not like you can keep those people locked up. Prostitutes, drug runners, laborers. Why don't they just escape? America is a big country, said Puller. And there's always a policeman nearby. Because they tell them that if they do try to escape or tell the police, their families will be killed, said Mako. How do you know this? Asked Diaz, looking at him curiously. I had a talk with two of Lambert's men. They told me, and his housekeeper. I could tell from the little she told me that she is a slave. She is afraid for her family. Lambert also uses her for sex. Mako's eyes drifted toward Diaz's when he said that last part, but she quickly looked away, her face reddening. Pola said, you had a talk with two of Lambert's men. Would they be the same pair that was staying at the plaza? Mako did not answer, which to Pola was answer enough. So you killed them. They were not human, not any longer. They were like rabid dogs. You still murdered them. You have not killed before? I have not murdered before, Diaz said. That can be dealt with later. Pola said, Mako, do you know anything about the death of an old lady and an old couple? Mako said, I saw an old couple killed on the beach when I first came here. On the beach, did you see who killed them? Mako shook his head. But it was one person, shots to the head. Then their bodies were dragged into the water. The tide took them out. And you just let it happen? There was nothing I could do. It happened so fast. Okay, their bodies were dragged out to the water, so probably a man, big, small, white, black, not that tall. I could not see the color of the skin clearly, but I think white, and slender, but obviously strong. And you blew up Lambert's Bentley, said Puller. Mako looked at him, puzzled. How did you know that? You have big feet. Diaz said, this can all keep. We need to be prepared for what is coming up in the next few minutes. Mako nodded. The warehouse. It is where they keep the slaves. That is where the trucks go. Then we should call the police, said Carson. No, said Diaz. Lambert and Rogers have assets everywhere. We can't trust the police. Then the U.S. military. Elgin is right up the road. By the time they can send anyone, it'll be too late. Puller had a sudden thought. You said this was a joint operation with the U.S. Did you happen to be working with military-looking guys in a Chrysler? Yes, said Diaz. They told me of their interaction with Americans. I guess that was you. Guess it was. Were they tracking me or Betsy Simon? They had spotted a car belonging to Simon near the transfer spot one night. They traced it to her. Then she was killed. They started watching. Where are they now? After their encounter with you, they were reassigned. No one has replaced them yet. Great, muttered Puller. Okay, give us the layout of the warehouse, said Carson. If they're still there, we'll have to hit it hard and fast. We will hit it hard and fast, said Mako, and we will kill who we have to kill. He looked at Puller. Unless you have a problem with murdering slavers. No problem at all, said Puller. If they're trying to murder me... That I think you can count on, said Mako. Chapter 82. There were four sides to the warehouse, and they covered all of them. They had to split their forces in quarters to accomplish this, but allowing a hole for anyone to escape was deemed not acceptable. Puller took the rear, Mako the front, Carson the left, Diaz the right. They were prepared for a war. They did not find one. They did not find anyone at all. The warehouse was empty. The makeshift prison cells held no one. They searched the space in 10 minutes and then regrouped in the center of it. Puller said, "They move fast. I'll give them that." "But where have they gone?" asked Carson. "We can get APBs out. They have to be using trucks to transport. Lot of trucks going up and down the highway. Can't stop and search them all." Puller glanced over her shoulder and stiffened. He raced past Carson and over to a spot against the wall. He knelt and picked it up. The others joined him. "What is it, Puller?" Puller held it up. It was a ring, a small silver ring with a lion on it. "This belongs to my friend Diego." "Who is this Diego?" asked Mako. "A kid, about 12 years old. His cousin is Mateo. He's 5. They were probably both here. Diego probably left this as a clue. He's a pretty smart kid." "A 5-year-old? Why would they have taken 12 and 5-year-old boys?" "Prostitution," said Puller. "Sick guys out there." "No, Rogers is a criminal and a truly evil man, but he has never taken anyone that young before. Diego didn't come through the normal pipeline. He lived in paradise. He was snatched from right here along with Mateo." Diaz looked worried. "What is it?" asked Carson. "Then it was Lambert who ordered this, not Roger." Puller rose and pocketed the ring. "So what exactly does that mean?" "It could mean that Lambert is expanding his product line without Roger's approval or even knowledge." "Expand it where?" "Terrorists." "What?" "You build mock families to divert suspicion, a mother, a father with young children. If you travel with little ones, security is instinctively lessened. It is against human nature to take your own children into harm's way." "Not in the Middle East," said Puller. "Happened all the time." "Yes, they were used as shields and sometimes bombs." "I understand this," said Diaz, "but this is not the Middle East, and the people who used children as shields and bombs were not their parents." Puller said, "So you're saying it's great cover to travel with small kids to avoid detection or at least heightened scrutiny?" "Maybe getting in and out of the country," added Carson. "Yes, that is what I'm thinking," said Diaz. Puller looked at Carson and he said, "I should have shot Lambert the night I met him." Diaz said urgently, "We need to find them." "They had to have trucked them out of here," said Puller. He looked at Mako. "Any idea how many people might have been here?" Mako looked around at the empty cells. "I watched the beach for 2 nights. Each night, 80 prisoners were brought in. So a lot of people to move. They are probably heading toward the interstate highways as we speak." Puller mulled this thought over as Carson stared at him. "I'm not too sure about that," he said. Where else? They have product to move. They have buyers. If I'm Lambert and I know my pipeline was compromised, then I'm not going to deliver the product to my buyers. He couldn't be sure it wouldn't be followed. That blows his pipeline sky high, and that also wins him a death sentence from Roger. What then? Asked Carson. What do you think he's doing with them? I think he's returning them to sender. Back to Colombia? Back to wherever they came from, said Puller. He looked at Mako. How did you get here? I swam mostly, said Mako, but Puller could tell by his face that the man was leaping ahead to the ultimate conclusion of Puller's question. I was one of the taken, he said. It sidetracked me for a bit, but I escaped. The crew who brought me was not so lucky. They were late, and it cost them their lives. Where did you escape from? An oil platform off the coast. No longer used, of course. They dock at a series of them, going from Mexico to Florida. That is how they move the product, Diaz said. But I didn't think there were any oil platforms off the coast of Florida. Carson spoke up. That's mostly true. The vast majority are off the coast of Louisiana and Texas, and some off Alabama. There are no oil platforms on the Atlantic side of Florida, and pretty much all the oil wells dug in Florida state waters in the Gulf over the years came up dry. Okay, said Puller, but Mako is saying there is one out there and that he was on it. How does that make sense? Carson continued. Some energy companies made natural gas discoveries in the mid-80s to mid-90s, about 25 miles off the coast, but the state of Florida objected to the gas being mined and the feds put the kibosh on it in the early 2000s. But there were some platforms built out there in anticipation of the gas being brought up. Energy companies usually have to dismantle the platforms within a certain amount of time, but I think there was litigation involved with those platforms. Nothing moves fast when the lawyers get involved. Pula stared at her. How do you know so much about it? I did a white paper on it for the DOD. I told you that we were looking into things like that for national security purposes. They were worried about terrorists using the abandoned platforms to enter the country, so I mapped pretty much every platform in the Gulf, and there are thousands of them that are abandoned in the process of being either dismantled or turned into reefs for marine life. Those are basically the two options for them. Did the DOD act on your paper? No, it went into the black hole where most white papers go, but we never thought about slavers using them. It's sort of like the opposite of the Underground Railroad during the Civil War, noted Pula, ferrying people to slavery instead of freedom. We never thought of slavers using the oil platforms either. Why should you, ask Mako? People like Rogers and Lambert spend every minute of their lives trying to stay one step ahead. Money, that is all they care about. So the last oil platform before here, do you know how to get back there? I believe so, yes. I tried as best I could to fix its position in my mind. We can call in the Coast Guard, said Cass, and they can send a cutter right at these guys. There's no way they can match that sort of firepower. I don't care how badass Rogers and Lambert are. A cutter is a big ship, countered Mako. They will see it coming from miles away. They will kill all the prisoners and be gone before the cutter even gets close. The same for aircraft. Well, we have to do something. We can't just let these people get away. A small force, stealth, at night, said Pula. That's our only shot. There's only four of us, said Diaz. A small force, like he said, observed Mako. Small in number, big in fight. But we can't we at least call in some help from the locals? I do not trust anyone. Neither do I, said Pula, but we're going to do it anyway. But first I have to make a phone call. A phone call to who? Demanded Carson. I need an answer, and this is the only way to get it. This concludes the 10th episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Your reader has been Chris Long.